From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Last week, the Republicans became the majority party in both the House and the Senate. So what might a Republican-controlled legislature mean towards environmental policies, regulations, and proposed legislation?
What changes, delays, and deferrals can we expect to see with respect to climate and energy policy?
And how might the fossil fuel industry benefit from Mitch McConnell's role as Senate Majority Leader and, worse, James Inhofe becoming the chairman of the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee?
And once the legislature is sworn in January, how many days before a provision to approve the Keystone XL pipeline gets inserted into an unassociated but critical spending bill?
Right. The over-under is 10.
Should we take bets?
That's the Vegas line right now.
Joining us to discuss what we can expect with regards to Republican control and environmental protection will be Dave Goldston, the Director of Government Affairs for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
That's in the second part of the show. In the first part, Nell and I will run down some of the environmental ballot initiatives that were up for a vote last week, including proposals to ban fracking and require GMO labeling. Also a report on annual conditions of the ozone hole, something we'll go over, and an interesting news item about expanding Goblin Valley State Park into the surrounding parks. Is that right?
Into the surrounding federal lands.
Oh,
yeah.
All right. We'll go over that, too.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. And it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Annika Simos from the Minor Detail Show on Saturdays from 7 to 8 p.m., bringing you the latest local news, updates on high school sports, and new music. A big thanks to Vail Resorts, Elliott Work Group, Richvine Realtor, and the UPS Store for supporting the Minor Detail Show and giving Park City High School students an opportunity to participate in the community.
Hi, this is John with Park City Nursery.
And this is Kay with the Park City Tree Ranch.
Supporting KPCW since 1983.
Between the two locations, we carry a variety of products to help your yard and garden flourish, including living plants, yard art, seeds, bark, compost, and organic products. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Across the board is co-host Nell Larson, and we're going to be talking to Dave Goldston. He's the Director of Government Affairs for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's coming on the second part of the show, and we're going to talk to him about the election results and what that means to environmental policy and legislation coming out of Washington, what it really means to the EPA, too. Mitch McConnell is the new Senate Majority Leader, and he's always talked about a war on coal. The Obama administration has a war on coal, and of course he's from Kentucky, and that's the center of the battle for him. Now that war on coal is going to change probably to a war on the EPA, and we're going to talk to Dave about what that means and what we can see over the next 2 years with respect to our air, water, and land quality. So that's in the second half of the show. It's going to be really interesting. But in the first part, Nell and I are going to chat about, among other things, some ballot initiatives. But
yeah,
let's start with a couple of items that you had, one with respect to the ozone and the latest on the ozone hole.
Yeah, so
the
hole in the ozone, I think, is something that we don't hear as much about anymore as we used to.
Because it was solved, wasn't it?
It's totally solved. It's completely done. It's finished. So it's monitored really carefully by NOAA and by NASA, mm-hmm, and some other groups. And so they kind of every year around this time tend to release some information on the size or the peak size of that the hole in the ozone over the Antarctic reaches.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, it reached its peak size on September 11th, and the size was 9.3 million square miles. And so that's hard to visualize, I think.
Yeah.
And that's similar in size to North America.
Okay.
So, I mean,
really?
It's huge.
Okay.
It's a massive hole.
That's an area that's 1,000 miles wide by 9,000 miles long. That's
there you go.
9 million That's roughly nine million miles. Okay.
Yeah. So, but the good news, I guess, is sort of like a no news. It's just exactly about the same size as last year. So it's been, it's been kind of decreasing in size since 2000, where it reached its peak size of 11.5 million square miles.
Okay.
And so it's come down a couple million square miles.
About 20, almost 20%.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that, you know, in the 70s, scientists started to talk about and theorize and study about the impacts of chlorine and chlorofluorocarbons on the ozone, but they first found the hole in the early 80s.
Yes.
And then not too much longer after that, the Montreal Protocol was passed.
Yes.
Which was an agreement to phase out the use of the chemicals that harm the ozone.
Those chlorofluorocarbons that were coming from, among other things, aerosol spray cans.
Right. Refrigerators. Like
refrigerators, deodorants, which back in the day were spray.
Yeah.
Aerosol spray. Okay.
Yeah. So the hole continued to grow for long after that because those CFCs and other chemicals can remain in the atmosphere for like 50 years. But since 2000, it seems to be coming down a little bit. There is variability year to year, just, you know, having to do with the weather.
Right.
But the climate change, of course, also is having some impacts, and they're not sure how big these are.
Right.
But as climate change increases, it can actually, of course, slow the recovery of the hole in the ozone.
Oh, it does.
By
okay.
impacting temperatures in the stratosphere. So, as we always say, everything's linked, everything's tied together. But the good news is that it's starting to stabilize. And then when they start to see the rates of increase in the size decrease, even if the hole is the same size, that's kind of like the next milestone that they're looking for.
So the hole is at its largest, greatest extent during the winter. Antarctica's winter time, which is our summer.
Right. It's kind of their springtime. So the light hits the Antarctic after this freezing cold winter down there,
that
sparks the chemical reactions that create this hole.
And you know how it happens that those little chlorine atoms are floating around at the amongst the ozone, and ozone is what? Three oxygen atoms.
That's right.
Kind of combined in what I call an uneasy alliance, because oxygen likes to have two atoms, O2. That's comfortable. Then a third oxygen atom comes along. Hey, can I join you guys? And they form up they're very unstable. They become O3. That's ozone. Then chlorine atom comes along and he actually gets in there and cleaves off one of the oxygen atoms. So now you have O2 plus an oxygen radical. And that's how ozone is destroyed. The chlorine atom comes in and breaks the bond.
There was a karate chop on that breaking of the bond.
I had to do that. That's about the bit. Yes.
Yeah.
It breaks the bond. So it goes to O2 and oxygen radical. So that's how the ozone, that's what ozone is. And that's how chlorine damages ozone at those levels.
And that increases apparently on the surface of ice particles in these frozen clouds.
Yes.
And so that's kind of, where this is all coming from. But it's always nice to talk about an environmental issue that's kind of on the upswing.
Encouraging.
Yeah, encouraging news. And all, everyone's expecting that in time, this annual ozone hole that forms will begin to really significantly decrease in size and eventually disappear. So.
And the Montreal Protocol, the other thing, actually worked.
Yeah.
In reducing the use of chlorofluorocarbons. One of the rare times that you had a bipartisan effort amongst countries, not just the U.S., but around the world.
Right, I was just going
to reduce their usage of chlorofluorocarbons and change chemical formulas, et cetera, to friendlier types of. Okay, so that's our ozone.
And that
update.
Was, and actually, one thing I wanted to note on that is that one of the guys who sort of discovered the ozone hole and presented at a conference recently did an interview, Pawan Bhartia, and he was talking about how it was 30 years ago, right about now, when he submitted the paper on this. And then, in his words, all hell broke loose when people kind of started to understand what was happening. And that got energized. So 30 years ago, right around this time of year.
Yeah.
In December.
There you go. Anniversary special. So next story is about Goblin State Park. That's a great park. Why is it called Goblin State Park?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yeah.
So there are formations in the park.
No, I'm asking.
Oh, are you talking to our listeners?
I'm asking our crack research team.
In the park that look like goblins. They're these incredible, like, hoodoo-like formations that are kind of a very unique shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a unique place, and you can wander around through all of these hoodoos and the goblins and climb around, and it's gorgeous. It's all red rock. Don't push things over. That's a bad idea. Boy Scout leaders.
Okay, but what's the news on it?
So this is just, I think it's interesting in the context of the fact that Utah is currently trying to, request that all of the federal land in Utah be given back to the state for state management.
Yes.
So with that in mind, Emory County and the Utah State Parks are working together on a plan to designate about a tenth of the San Rafael Swell, the swell as people commonly call it, as a new, quote, heritage park that would be linked to an expansion of Goblin Valley. So the key piece here is that it would take that land from management under the BLM, where it currently is, the Bureau of Land Management, mm-hmm. and it would put it under the state management. And so that would be a big change for the area. And they're saying this would be an improvement environmentally because right now it's, overrun. There's a lot of visitation. There's not a lot of management outside the park. And they would look at permit systems and, various access just management or limitation. So it'll be really interesting to see where that goes. But Rob Bishop asked the state parks to come up with kind of a wish list of where they would like to see an expansion in state parks, and this is one of those areas. So stay tuned and kind of keep an eye on this issue.
Do you have an idea how much larger it would be?
The park would grow? 130,000 acres.
130,000?
Yeah, so huge. It's a massive area.
That's 20, it's almost 200 square miles. 640 acres per mile. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So significant increase there. And, that park, the state park, has already seen a huge increase in visitation. It's like quadrupled or something. Doubled over the past 4 years. So it's a busy area. And I don't know that making the entire thing a state park would make it any less busy. I think it might make it more busy.
Yeah.
But there would be more management in place.
Right.
So it's, it's a balancing
act. Pros and cons to it. So what is there a schedule of decision making going forward?
No, it is all very, as far as I can tell, all very loosey-goosey at this point.
Okay, good. We'll follow that. We'll track that. I'll tell you what, let's take a break for a couple underwriters. And when we come back, we'll turn our attention to some of the ballot initiatives that were, on ballots around the country last Tuesday with respect to some environmental issues like GMOs and fracking, conservation, etc.
Including one of the ones that Chris mentioned last week that took place in Texas, which is kind of in the forefront, I think, of public interest.
You would not foresee this one coming. We'll give you the details. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
The Egyptian Theater welcomes the California Guitar Trio Thursday and Friday, November 13th and 14th. California Guitar Trio, somewhat contrary to their name, are three guitarists from three continents who explore multiple musical genres within the universes of rock, jazz, world, surf, and classical music. See California Guitar Trio at the Egyptian Theater. Tickets are $19 and up on Thursday night, $23 and up on Friday. ParkCityShows.com. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers cash incentives for energy-efficient appliances, cooling equipment, insulation, and other improvements for your home. More ways to save energy and money at wattsmart.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts, sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson across the board. Joining us in the second half of the show will be Dave Golston. He's the Government Affairs Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council. I always said national. So how many times have I said Natural Resources Defense Council? But what we want to do now is spend the next few minutes talking about some ballot initiatives around the country that were either passed or failed with respect to environmental impacts, we'll say.
That's right. Last week, we talked about a couple of these coming up. Chris kind of gave us the list of some that we would be watching.
Yeah.
And I think we'll hit those.
Yeah. And the first one is Denton, Texas. Denton, Texas is a town of about 100,000 people north of Dallas. It also sits above a very active shale formation and holds a lot of natural gas. There were literally hundreds of wells drilled throughout the city of Denton over the last, 4, 5, 6 years, extracting this gas, and most of them required hydraulic fracturing, high volume slick water hydraulic fracturing or fracking to get to this gas in a cost-effective way. Because you could drill wells straight down without fracking and you would only get so much gas it wasn't worth it. Okay, so they're using a lot of fracking techniques. And they're also drilling wells in areas that otherwise you would not really want to have a well drilled, like in your neighborhood.
Right. There are these incredible images of wells like next door to neighborhoods and homes and community churches.
Hundreds of feet from homes in some locations. So they cause a lot of stir and a lot of controversy. So a number of people, a grassroots effort was drawn up to put a fracking ban on the ballot. And they got enough signatures to a petition for that, and it went to a vote, and they won. There is now a temporary ban or moratorium on installing any additional wells using fracking. Now,
so the current wells will continue to operate.
To operate. You can drill, again, for natural gas in the city of Denton, inside the city limits, but you can't use fracking to do it. So otherwise, again, it's not worth a driller's efforts to go just drill a normal well. You can't get enough gas to pay the bills. So in effect, you will not see any additional wells being drilled in the city of Denton. So it passed, and it has... Now, the takeaway here is the next day, a number of interests in the oil and gas industry filed suit to challenge that moratorium.
And I'm sure they've been preparing these suits for months now, as soon as they knew that there was, you know, this initiative would be on the ballot and that it was looking like there was a lot of support for it.
Right. David Spence, professor of law, politics, and regulation at the University of Texas, said that now that this initiative is passed, it's going to draw lawsuits from oil and gas companies. Spence said that he expected lawsuits based on two claims. One, state rules outweigh local laws.
Okay.
So if the state allows it, you can't pass a local law that counters state law.
Okay.
That's one approach they could take. The second one is that landowners have a right to use the land in the way they want to. Private land rights, right?
Sure.
And they can't have that right taken away from them without just compensation. So he's saying that these are the approaches that, in this case, the oil and gas interests will take to challenge any bans or moratoriums on drilling, drilling on private property.
And fracking.
In this case, fracking in private property. So the ban passed in Denton. They join other towns like Longmont, Colorado, and Dryden, New York.
Okay.
Remember that one? Dryden, that have put bans or moratoriums.
They're, in New York, one of the big concerns is the water quality piece.
Okay, yeah. And there are actually three Colorado cities and one in town in Ohio also passed ballot measures banning or temporarily halting fracking within their borders. Okay. So, but measures in Santa Barbara County and Youngstown, Ohio did not pass. They were defeated. So no fair. So mixed bag, but the point is it's on more ballots. You're going to see more and more challenges to fracking, and it's going to be
right, not just one isolated little area. It's
right,
literally from sort of coast to coast across the country.
Right. So
and each place kind of has a different primary concern. Like Ohio, one of the big things you hear about is earthquakes. And how that may be coming from some of the processes associated with fracking. So,
yeah, exactly. That's why it's a big interest there. But Ohio has a lot of gas beneath its surface. And so there's a lot of growing efforts to drill some more and more in Ohio. One other one, we got a few minutes. This one about GMO. Maui County, Hawaii has placed a complete moratorium on the cultivation of genetically engineered crops within the county. And I said, wow, so I can't grow GMOs in my
in your yard?
In my garden?
Yeah.
No, they have a very big agricultural interest there, and it's Monsanto. Monsanto is a producer, one of the interests in growing sugarcane, coffee, and pineapple.
Well, one of the things that like shocked me about this passing is that Monsanto was there, and usually they just like fund these things so that there's no chance that it'll possibly
pass. And the opponents to this initiative raised nearly $8 million to oppose the measure.
Wow!
To ban us, and it was the most expensive campaign in Hawaii state history.
Wow!
This issue, banning GMOs. So, but again, the citizens of Maui County approved a moratorium on the use of genetically engineered crops, or the growing of genetically engineered crops within their county. Now, again, this is going to be challenged in court in one fashion or another.
There's going to be a formidable opponent on that one.
Yes.
That's for sure.
So that's GMO. Now, GMO labeling. Efforts to require labeling of GMOs on products failed in Oregon, and I think also in Colorado. In Colorado, Proposition 105, which pushed for the labeling of genetically modified foods, to bear a label reading, quote-unquote, produced with genetic engineering, unquote. That's all they wanted, basically a label. That failed. Now, interesting enough, Chipotle, the restaurant chain, and Whole Foods came
Chipotle,
out.
Chipotle, who we've interviewed.
Yeah, they came out in support of the labeling.
Wow.
Both of them.
Whole Foods and Chipotle.
Of course, the usual suspects, Monsanto, PepsiCo, and Kraft came out against it. Those groups raised $12 million to fight this ban. But the outcome, the Colorado voters resoundingly rejected Proposition 105, with nearly 70% of the voters voting no.
How does that happen?
That's amazing.
It's shocking.
Yeah. Well, a similar measure in Oregon, where you think it would. state?
Pass with flying colors.
Or Vermont. they also narrowly defeated GMO labeling requirements. So that's interesting with respect to GMOs.
Yeah.
And labeling.
Because in the past, we've heard from a couple of counties where it has had a lot of support. So,
yeah. So that's
interesting.
That's
to
interesting.
See where those go.
We won't see that one go away for a while.
No.
But it hasn't passed yet. So, all right. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll hopefully have Dave Goldston from the Natural Resources Defense Council on the line talking more about what is going to happen in Washington now that the Republicans control both the Senate and the House of Republicans. Freudian slip. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. Chris Cherniak along with Nell Larson. So now, incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky has said one of his top priorities is to, quote, get the EPA reined in, unquote. McConnell ran on fighting back against the president's so-called war on coal, a key piece of reelection campaign. Will his war on coal now become a war on the EPA? Joining us to discuss this issue and other items related to the Republican, now the Republican control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives is David Goldston. David is the Director of Government Affairs for the Natural Resources Defense Council, and in that role, he's responsible for the NRDC's overall political strategy. He served as Chief of Staff of the House Committee on Science from 2001 through 2006. I got some questions about that. Dave, thanks for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess hopefully you heard my little lead-in to this. Now that Senator McConnell is heading things up with the Senate, is the majority leader. And we also have we have Republicans controlling some of the subcommittees, like James Inhofe and Lisa Murkowski. What's the overall take? What's the 30,000-foot view of what we see with respect to the potential impacts to environmental policies and regulations these next 2 years?
Well, Senator McConnell and Speaker Boehner have made clear that they intend to try to continue to run a tax on environmental protection, starting with or at least including taking on limits on carbon pollution and trying to block those. We don't think that they'll succeed, but I think the profile of environmental issues will be much higher over the next 2 years because they're going to be a flashpoint between the Republican majority and the White House.
Right. So, in this morning's New York Times, an interesting article that addresses just this issue. Let's say, for example, I talk about McConnell. He's always talking about the war on coal because, you know, he comes from Kentucky, so coal is king there. What is this war on coal, and why is it not true? Kind of a leading question there, but you know where I'm coming from.
Right. So, I mean, the war on coal is, you know, a line that they've come up with to try to attack really doing anything whatsoever to address climate change.
Right.
The coal obviously has, we use less coal than we have before. That's largely because of changes in market forces with natural gas becoming cheaper. But there's no question that coal is an inherently dirty fuel, both in terms of its impact on climate and in the kind of conventional pollutants that cause health problems and aggravate respiratory diseases and so forth. So it's not a war on coal. It's an effort to improve health and protect the planet. And there are ways to do that where coal will continue to be part of the power mix for the time being. The administration's plans don't put coal out of business, but they do acknowledge the facts that coal is pretty much the dirtiest power source we have, and that over time we have to do something about that.
Right. Actually, out here out west, of course, Utah, our mix is roughly 80% coal for electricity production. But also out west, we're seeing a lot more coal, particularly in Wyoming, heading overseas. You know, actually, there's quite a healthy market right now for the Western coal to find markets in Asia, et cetera. And that's supposed to continue. So Kentucky's challenges sometimes is it's just that they're in a bad location because, like you say, more and more power plants back east are turning to natural gas and maybe some renewables.
Right. Well, in east, even power plants in the east tend to use more coal from the west than they once did because it, as coal goes, it produces less pollutants. But the but in terms of climate, obviously, we have to reduce worldwide coal use with carbon dioxide. It doesn't matter where it's emitted. The
right.
The impacts are global.
Right.
So one of the other things we wanted to ask you about today is the Keystone Pipeline. There's a headline in the New York Times right now that says Republicans vow to approve Keystone Pipeline. Where do you see this heading?
So I think, as in most of these issues, I mean, we should take the Republicans at their word, and if they say they're going to attack these things, they are likely to attack them. I think on the Keystone Pipeline, we're likely to see an effort early in the new Congress, if not in the lame duck session of this Congress, with Republicans trying to force the president's hand to approve the Keystone Tar Sands Pipeline. We think the president will hold fast, and we will certainly be doing everything we can to encourage the White House to reject any effort to force the president to approve the pipeline. We think that, you know, it's continued. We think the pipeline should be rejected because of its impact on climate. But we, at the very least, the process that's been ongoing should be completed. And, you know, this is a sometimes since the election, the Republican leaders have said, oh, we want to reach out with an olive branch and we want to try to figure out ways that we can work together. Having one of the earliest things they do be a proposal that takes away authority that presidents have had for decades to make decisions about cross-border projects is a funny way to initiate a peacemaking process. So if the Republican leaders are interested in actually working together on energy issues, there are things that there could be agreement on, such as energy efficiency proposals that have bipartisan support and that the White House supports, proposals to continue the tax credits for solar and wind energy, which have many Republican supporters and which the White House also supports. So if they are interested in working together and getting things done on energy, those are some of the things they could start with.
So if I understand the mechanics of the process, could they bundle some of these proposals into a bill or so, but then also include require approval of the pipeline as part of that bundled effort?
Yeah, they could do a number of things. I mean, they can do these as freestanding bills, which may be one of the things they would do with the pipeline. But they've also said that one of their strategies will be to throw these proposals onto spending bills. These are the bills that have to be signed into law to keep the government going. And so basically that's not an appropriate way to legislate. It increases the chance for having one of these games of chicken about whether the government will shut down, which is one of the things that has most alienated the public from the current way things are done in Washington. And, you know, there's no reason to do that. It's just a way to try to hold the president hostage. And, you know, in the past, the White House has basically said, we're not going to play that game. We shouldn't have these extraneous provisions on spending bills. Let's take care of the spending and keep the government running and have these debates as separate policy debates. And we're likely to see that kind of dispute again because, again, Speaker Boehner and incoming Leader McConnell have made no secret of their plans to try to load up spending bills any way that they can. Interestingly, at the same time, Mitch McConnell has said, you know, we're not going to shut down the government, but that means that, you know, they're going to just put everyone through this, you know, to go up to the edge and see who wins.
Right.
Again, not an appropriate way to legislate.
Right. So a spending bill goes to the president's desk. Within it is this approval of the pipeline. The president vetoes it. Then it goes back to the Senate, where it would require, what, two-thirds or 67 votes?
Correct.
To override, and that's not going to happen.
Right. So I mean, they don't have the – we don't think they have the votes to override a presidential veto on Keystone, whether it's freestanding or as part of a spending bill in either the House or the Senate.
Okay. So like you say, these are the games of chicken that will go on for a while.
Right. And it's unlikely, or I should say it's likely from what they're saying, that if they did that on a spending bill, they would do it with more than just Keystone Pipeline. They'd probably go after climate action. They could go after a whole range of environmental issues, air, water, endangered species, lands policy.
Hmm.
They have a long agenda of things that they would like to block.
they sound anti-environmental.
It's almost like.
Is that another leading question?
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead, Mel.
So one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, posts popping up in social media and in the news about kind of like, well, it's not all bad. There are silver linings. What do you make of that? And are there any areas where you see progress being able to be made, or any pros to these new sort of, you know, increase Republican influence?
One of the things that's sometimes seen as a silver lining, and whether that's the right term or not, I think the phenomenon is true, which is that poll after poll shows that the public, you know, supports environmental action, including on things like climate change. And the degree to which these have been under threat and under attack by the Republicans has not, I think, fully hit home, partly because the House of Representatives has passed literally hundreds, taken hundreds of anti-environmental votes in recent years, but it hasn't gotten a lot of coverage because the media attitude has been, well, the Senate's never going to let that through anyway, and so we're not going to write about it. What will happen now is these attacks will be front-page news, and they'll get much more visibility if there's some kind of standoff with the president, between the Congress and the president, on whether to take action on climate change. That issue is going to be hard to ignore. And so we think what will happen is the public will understand much more of what's at stake here. Hopefully that will get the Republican Party to change its tune, but if not, it will strengthen the hands of those who do want action. And so we think in terms of the longer-term trajectory of these issues, seeing what's really at stake will be helpful to the environmental agenda.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with David Goldston. He's the Director of Government Affairs with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're talking about the potential impacts and looking down the road with respect to environmental issues, policies, regulations, now that there's a Republican-led majority in the federal legislature.
You know, Chris, let me hop in before you ask that next question. We're getting a lot of people trying to call in during this interview. And so I want to remind people, we can't take their call on the air, but you can post your question on our Facebook page, or you can email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org, and we will be able to pass your question or comment along to our speaker today.
Yeah, so, we got another 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Do that. Good idea.
So, can I just say one other thing on the sure. question just asked, which is, you know, I mean, there are Republicans who in the past, and there are Republicans now, who support action on these issues. They're not in the leadership. And one question that the party will have to face as this goes forward, and again, as they figure out where they stand in 2016, is which wing of the Republican Party is going to shape policy on these critical issues. So it's a battle within the Republican Party, as well as between Congress and the White House and between the parties.
Okay, that's a good point. But now let's turn our attention to the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
You now have, like I said, you have Senator James Inhofe,
mm-hmm.
denialist, you know, exemplar of from Oklahoma, a climate denialist. He's the now probably the chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee. You have Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who will probably be the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. David, how many days a week do you see EPA officials being dragged into Senate subcommittee hearings to get otherwise chided and yelled at for the next 2 years?
Well, again, that is part of this question about sort of how the Republicans want to behave with their new majority. I mean, they have been saying, we understand that the public actually wants action, that the public actually wants to see government working. You know, doing day after day of show trial is not a way for that to happen. And we'll see whether that's the approach that the incoming chairs take. I think certainly, you know, with Senator Inhofe has made no secret of where he stands on climate, and we don't expect to see his views change. He's called it, you know, a hoax, infamously, and right. He's even written a book saying that. That's, you know, the fact that he's the head of the Environment Committee, people can reach their conclusions on. But it's really, the agenda is really going to be driven by the Senate leadership, and so the attacks on climate action will obviously go through the Environment Committee, and Senator Inhofe will no doubt have a field day with that. But yeah. But this is not a matter of, you know, individual personalities. This is party leadership who have said, we're going to stake our positions, at least to start out, on the grounds of climate denial and blocking climate action. And again, what they've called for, at least so far, isn't, oh, we've got a different way to do this or anything like that. It's raising questions about whether climate change even exists,
right,
and trying to block EPA from actually trying to strip away EPA's authority to address the problem at all. That should raise questions even among people who may have questions about the, may have criticisms of specific administration proposals. They're going way far to the other side.
So that was kind of going to be my next question, is just how long can this climate denial conversation go on? Do you think that will start to shift into how to address it, or even whether or not to address it?
Right.
But will it go beyond this isn't happening?
Well, that's a good question. I'd say it's already gone on a lot longer than I ever would have predicted, but we're starting to see changes. So the line that many Republicans have started to use about I'm not a scientist,
yeah,
which, you know, is ridiculous. I mean, it's sort of a non sequitur. You wouldn't think that the next line would be, and therefore I'm not going to listen to any. But the fact that they're taking this approach is kind of a defensive crouch. It's a way to try to move away from something that is so clearly outright climate denial. So what you're seeing is them trying to figure out what to do with this, and that's a sign that they have felt like politically and presumably scientifically that outright climate denial isn't a sustainable position for them. So that's a good sign. Now we need them to move from this kind of, you know, nonsensical verbal feint into actually acknowledging where the science is and taking a position on action. And so I think, you know, that's the direction things are going to, but we're, you know, we're going to have to go through this, you know, firefight over EPA action first, I think.
Right.
Hopefully this will gradually change. You know, it wasn't that long ago when you had leaders in both parties calling for climate action. I mean, in President Obama's first election in 2008, I mean, both he and Senator McCain supported climate action. Senator McCain at the time was a leading sponsor of legislation for climate action in the Senate. So it's, you know, we've gone backward far enough that now it's hard to remember that it wasn't, you know, in the distant mists of the past when both parties had a positive climate position. We can get that to that place again.
Well, it seemed like you say, not long ago, we had more moderate mindsets on the Republican side, the conservative side, that would sit down and consider these issues, McCain, et cetera. then you have the Tea Partiers come in. And I just don't see Tea Partiers being very interested in environmental issues, and most importantly, climate-related policies.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, and the question will be, will the hardest-edged Tea Partiers control the Republican agenda, or can there start being movement? Because, again, I mean, the polls indicate the public does want to see action in this area.
So switching over to the Democratic side of the party here, do you have any Democrats in mind that maybe you think can be successful in working with the new leadership in Congress, or that maybe championing environmental issues successfully?
Well, I think it depends on the issue. So there's no reason that there can't be work together, and again, there have been on things like energy efficiency. There has been on things like infrastructure, roads, and transit. But on on these fundamental issues, I think if the Republican leadership's stance is going to be, and what they've said so far, which is measure after measure to block action, strip EPA authority away, not acknowledge environmental and health problems, then obviously those Republican efforts are going to have to be defeated. That doesn't mean that cooperative work can't go on at the same time on areas where there may be room for agreement. But the desire to have agreement can't trump the need to block extreme measures.
Right. Well, one thing that can be done with any federal agency is to cut their spending, cut their budget.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like a popular tact. And with respect to the EPA, they'll just cut their budget, and so you have less money for oversight and enforcement. Do you see that happening?
That will absolutely be, one of our concerns in the coming year. I mean, in the budget for the year that we're already in, which hasn't been officially approved yet, the overall numbers will probably protect that. But for the coming years, that's something that, again, that Republican House, without which, hadn't gotten enough attention, but now probably will, proposed, deep cuts in EPA, in the clean energy parts of the Department of Energy, and so on. And so that'll be clearly one of the battle rounds once we get to the spending for the next fiscal year, which is fiscal 2016, which starts October 1st.
We got a couple more minutes, David. Here's something I'm curious about. Lisa Murkowski has been trying to champion the idea of allowing U.S. to export crude oil, something we can't do now, with a few exceptions. As her role as the chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, do you see those efforts continuing?
So I should say NRDC actually hasn't taken a position on the crude oil export ban. It's an issue that divides industry, divides the parties,
mm-hmm.
So it's a little hard to know where they'll end up on it. Our view is that regardless of what happens with the export ban, our U.S. policy needs to be designed to reduce U.S. oil use. The Obama administration has actually made great strides on that, thanks to the fuel economy standards that have been put in place for cars and light trucks, and that will be for heavy-duty trucks, since almost all oil use in the U.S. is for transportation.
So before we wrap up, I just want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about where NRDC's role will be in the coming years and the focus, and also how listeners can get involved on these issues.
Yeah, so thanks. NRDC will be leading the battle to continue to have environmental progress. That means both on the defensive side in Congress, preventing these attacks that we've been talking about from succeeding, and pushing the administration to continue to move forward. So on climate, the administration has proposed limits for the first time, national limits on the amount of carbon pollution power plants can put into the atmosphere. There are no limits on that right now. The proposal is due to be final next year, and we want to make sure that that goes through and that it's the toughest proposal, that the most effective proposal that that is technically and economically feasible. And so we'll be working on all these issues. We obviously need the public. Congress does respond to the public. The White House does respond. They need to hear that people are against rollbacks, and they need to hear that people in the White House need to hear that people are for progress. And so the more that people can write in to their representatives in the White House, the better, and we'll be trying to activate the grassroots every way we can.
Good. That's great. Website, and do you blog?
I do occasionally. We have many other bloggers in our programs at NRDC, and the way is just www.nrdc.org, and you'll be able to get lots of issues, interest, lots of information on environmental issues, as well as political, you know, letters to political figures you can click on, and blogs to provide news and comment on the latest environmental developments.
Perfect. David Goldstein, he is Government Affairs Director with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And again, we want to thank you for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, Dave. Let's take a break for last couple of underwriters, and we come back, it'll be time to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
What would life in Park City be like without KPCW? Who would immediately report news and issues important to our area? KPCW is launching the Broadcasters Club, a major giving initiative for donors who are committed to securing a future for local radio. Broadcasters Club members commit to an annual financial contribution. Benefits include on-air recognition, exclusive outings, events, and more. For more information on how you can invest in your community radio, please call Cindy at 435-513-2929.
Time to wrap up on This Green Earth. Let's again thank Dave Goldstein from the NRDC, talking about what a Republican-led Senate and House of Representatives means to future environmental policies and legislation. It means a lot. we'll be tracking
Turns out
that.
That's pretty important.
Yeah, exactly. But also, it's important, let's thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties.
You can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
And you can email us your thoughts, ideas, comments to thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Thanks again, Nell. Good job.
You too,
as
Chris.
Always.
Cheers.
We'll be back with another show next Tuesday, every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Remember, but also remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.